what the lion's most powerful weapon is? It's his roar. It's that roar that enables the lion to take what is rightfully his. Diego, stop scratching your nuts.
Sorry.
It's time you guys got your shit together. I want to see some goddamn lions. You see that? You think a lion asks for his dinner? He takes it!
What does he do? Let me hear you say it.
Louder.
You think a lion asks for a promotion?
He takes it.
Does a lion wait for approval?
He takes it.
Right now, none of your worst shit. But starting tonight, we're going to shed our skin and become something entirely new. Forget your past lives, gentlemen. From this point on, you're all lions.
Have you got that straight? From this point on, you're all lions. Yeah, this terrible Tommy in the bunker right here, sharpening my knives and checking my ammo and getting ready for whatever. Yeah, they say today they're going to spread chemicals all over our beautiful area here, trying to get rid of some kind of something that endangers the crops. And they say, you see our plane going over with this toxic material coming out of it, well, stay in your house. But how long? As long as we tell you to. That's what's going on here in Indiana today, north central Indiana, on a beautiful sunshiny day right here. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And I think just about everybody's got their donation in for the radio show, and that's great. So, well, today is back to school day again. We're taking almost the whole week on school history. There's some things about history that lead us in the right direction of what to do today or what not to do. And what's not to do is to have fratricide between white countries and white counties and white states killing each other to the benefit of the non-white peoples. And the predatory capitalists and all that kind of stuff. So in just a minute, we're going to begin. Well, this is one of the most controversial wars we've had, and it's the war with Mexico. Early in the 19th century, the people of the United States, especially those of the Southwest, became interested in that part of Mexico known as Texas. The Louisiana Purchase was made in 1803. Settlers went immediately into that region along the Mississippi River. The expansion movement then grew rapidly, as we have seen, and was the major cause of the War of 1812. American settlers pushed into Mexico and soon got control of that section now known as Texas, where there were few Mexicans. And there wasn't much representation, too, because their politics was linked to a state in southern Mexico. So that particular state in Mexico got all the attention, and the people who lived in Texas didn't get much out of Mexico City. These citizens of the United States went there on the assumption that Texas would someday become part of the United States. Much of Texas was suited for the raising of cotton, hence slavery was profitable. So we put a bunch of Negroes and untouchables into Texas, the very first mistake racially we made. In 1827, Mexico passed a law providing for the gradual abolition of slavery. That was Mexico, not the United States. The people of Texas interested in slavery resented this, as did the pro-slavery faction in the United States. See, we've been chasing the dollar all from the very beginning. Very lucrative cotton business, which benefited a small percentage of the people at the top, but didn't really benefit the people at the bottom very much, and it certainly didn't benefit the Negro much. Except he got his foothold into the North American continent. Sentiment in Texas for secession crystallized rapidly, and in 1836, Texas seceded from Mexico, later asking to be annexed to the United States. I wonder if that had been a reverse situation, what would have happened? Some of the anti-slavery groups opposed this annexation, which would increase the slave territory. In other words, increase the black population. In her Constitution of 1837, Texas legalized slavery, which was an anti-white program. Whether they realized it or not, it was a pro-capitalist program, but anti-white in the long run. It was not until 1845 that Texas was admitted as a state. And if you doubt what I'm saying about the blacks moving into Texas, go down to Texas now and look at how the blacks have prospered and spread all over the place. And they never should have been there in the first place. But thank the land speculators and plantation owners and the rich for that attack on the white race. See, we've had a lot of white power in this country, but it was the wrong kind of white power. Polk of Tennessee, an ardent expansionist, was elected president by the Democrats in 1844. Manifest Destiny had then become the slogan of the Democratic Party. In other words, we are ordained by God to take whatever we want, to make money. Again, not to proliferate the race, but to make lots of money. According to President Tyler, secured the annexation of Texas as a state just before his term of office closed in 1845, a few days before he seceded by Polk. Of course, this, of course, was a land grab, too, because they took it from Mexico. Texas, in revolt from Mexico, claimed more territory than she had possessed while a Mexican state. Her southern boundary had then been the Nueces River, but after revolting, she laid claim down to the Rio Grande River. This area between the Nueces River and the Rio Grande was sparsely settled, but its inhabitants were Mexicans and included the Mexican settlements at the mouth of the Rio Grande. Now remember, a lot of the leading people in Mexico were white. A lot of people forget that. Polk did not desire war, but he was eager to acquire this disputed territory. He sent John Slidell of Louisiana as minister to Mexico to induce Mexico to accept the Rio Grande as the southern boundary of Texas rather than the Nueces River, which had been the southern boundary of Texas while in a Mexican province. Slidell was also instructed to buy from Mexico the territory now comprising the states of New Mexico, California, Arizona, Utah, Nevada, and part of Colorado. Such a deal, all of which was then part of Mexico. Mexico, however, refused to receive Slidell or consider the disposing of that territory on the ground that the United States had annexed Texas, although Mexico had not acknowledged its independence. When Polk could not acquire this desired territory by negotiation, he ordered General Taylor to enter the Rio Grande Territory. This was done on January 13, 1846. On May 9, 1846, Polk notified the cabinet of his intention to recommend a war with Mexico within a few days, by which means he hoped to take the territory he could not buy. Well, according to all the standards of war that I know about, that would have been an illegal act of war. Of course, most wars are illegal acts. On the night of May 9, 1846, news came to President Polk that on April 24, 1846, the American Army had a skirmish with Mexican forces. On May 11, 1846, President Polk sent a message to Congress stating Mexico had shed American blood on American soil. That's usually the excuse for an expanded war. just like the Gulf of Tonkin in the Vietnam War. War exists, and notwithstanding, all our efforts to avoid it exist by the act of Mexico or herself. Sounds like the newspeak coming out of Washington today. And 2 days later, on May 13, 1846, President Polk informed his cabinet that the United States must acquire New Mexico, California, and the surrounding Southwest Territory as a result of the war. Some of the cabinet members wanted to take all of Mexico. See how these guys go? Come on, you know, whether you like it or not, this is what happened. Secretary of State Buchanan, in a public letter, said, "Destiny beckons us to hold and civilize Mexico." How about that? There was quite a percentage of whites in Mexico, and many of them in leadership. I doubt whether they needed civilized, because many of them had European education. Americans had often tried to incite rebellions in Mexico. Many were arrested there and shot for treason. The United States, however, had never discouraged her citizens from trying to dismember Mexico. The circumstances surrounding the outbreak of the hostilities between General Taylor and the Mexicans were these. President Polk had ordered the General Taylor to enter the Rio Grande River region with American troops. He was arbitrarily accepting the Rio Grande and not the Nueces River as the southern boundary of Texas. The American troops marched down to the Rio Grande opposite Matamoros, a Mexican village south of the Rio Grande. They then blockaded the town and cut off its outlet from the Rio Grande. Mexicans crossed over the Rio Grande to drive the Americans away and to make them cease their interference with this Mexican village. Some Americans were killed in the skirmish, more white people dead. Rhodes, on page 87, volume 1, The History of the United States, says Mexico was actually goaded on to the war, unquote. Mexico had notified the United States that the annexation of Texas would be treated as a cause of war. The Mexican press made threats, yet there were so many internal quarrels in Mexico that open hostilities could have been avoided if the United States had not taken the position of supporting Texas in her claim to the Rio Grande as her southern boundary, disregarding the Nueces River as the southern boundary of Texas while a Mexican province. Webster, Clay, Calhoun, Benton, and Tyler regarded the war as a result of poor management on the part of President Polk. The Whig Party generally criticized it, while the Democrats usually favored it, although as the war continued, both groups were won over to its support. You see, back then, even now, the Democrats were the war party, and they had been the war party all the way up until what? Into the last century, all the way up through World War II, and even Vietnam and Korea. But then the Republicans took over as the war party. The Massachusetts legislature resolved in April 1847, during hostilities, that the war had been unconstitutionally commenced by the order of the president for the dismemberment of Mexico, unquote. Lincoln also criticized the war while it was in progress. He voted for a resolution offered by Mr. Ashburn in the House declaring that the war had been unnecessarily and unconstitutionally begun. On December 22, 1847, Mr. Lincoln offered the famous Spot Resolution, calling for the President to furnish Congress with information regarding the spot where hostilities had begun. A pamphlet was sent to Mr. Lincoln in which the author claimed that, in view of all the facts, the government of the United States had committed no aggression in Mexico. To this, Mr. Lincoln replied, "It is a fact that the United States Army, in marching to the Rio Grande, marched into a peaceful settlement and frightened the inhabitants away from their houses and their growing crops. It is a fact that Fort Brown, opposite Matamoros, was built by that army within a Mexican cotton field on which at the time the army reached it a young cotton crop was growing, which crop was wholly destroyed. And the field itself greatly and permanently injured by ditches, embankments, and the like, unquote. Although Lincoln voted for army supplies, he always criticized the war. For this, Lincoln's patriotism was questioned by Douglas in 1858 during the Lincoln-Douglas debates. General Grant, in his memoirs, Volume 1, page 53, said he considered the Mexican War one of the most unjust ever waged by a stronger against a weaker nation. The direct cost of the conflict was $100 million, with a death list of 12,000 men. And, of course, nearly all of these 12,000 men were white Aryans. So another situation where disregarding race just to acquire more land, and usually illegally acquiring it. Well, as you hear more and more facts about these wars, I hope you're getting the right impression, and it's not taught in the schools much anymore, and if anybody talks about it, it's anti-war people, and they're accused of being communists. So tomorrow we're going to have a long session. It's going to be on the Civil War, and that'll give us a lot more ammo for different sides and different points of view. And because we're going to have the Bluebellies and we're going to have the Graybacks, the Confederates and the Yankees, whites, that are all poised to kill off a quarter of a million white people, and that was primarily the troops. The number of white civilians, women, and children that were killed during the Civil War, I've never seen a figure on it. They don't like to talk about that. Happy days are here again. Our people are involved in wars all over the world. 700 military bases, that's the ones we know about. There's a lot of secret ones, I'm sure. So, and it just keeps growing. How about that? So should the, now the question I'm asking you is, I've already decided myself, white Aryan resistance is going to stand as an anti-war racist organization. We're racist, and we're a separatist, racist separatist outfit, and we're anti-war, especially where American white people, I shouldn't even say American, or Aryan people are dying. That interferes with our Aryan comradeship throughout the world. Whites all over the world got to stick together, and try to work things out with other people, too. So anyhow, from now on, when you talk to your conservative, or your even populist friends now, just remind them that white Aryan resistance is an anti-war outfit, okay? It's sort of strange. White Aryan resistance is anti-war. So we're separating from all that bullshit that we used to support in the past. At least I am, and that's what I'm going to do. Now, there may be a lot of anti-war groups that we don't agree with on the race issue and other things, but wherever we can agree on anti-war, and we'll work with them on that level. We don't have to agree with their other positions. Well, here's a question from one of our followers or interested follower, comrades or whatever you want to call them, or somebody that's just plain interested in our opinion. T.T., do you think those white racists who blame the Jews for everything bad or the problems that the white race is having today is not being logical? No, it's delusional. And here, like I say, the main problem of our racial problems is our race itself. We have the ability and the brains and all, everything that goes with it to solve our own problems if we quit bringing problems on ourselves. And if we could exclude and cause the deportation of all the whites that want a race mix and everything else, things would be fine. But the scapegoat thing is true in a lot of cases. They find somebody they want to blame everything on, like the Jews or the blacks, and they ride that. The right wing has done that for decades and decades and decades. You hardly ever go to a rally where a guy will stand up, which I have done, and said, our problem is our own race. If we straighten out our own race, we won't have any problems with these other races. So that's my answer to that. They're not logical. Well, let's have a little news on the war front, international front. Our Lady Zira is going to give it to you.
Exclusive. As the West is sucked deeper into the Syrian conflict and starts a new Cold War with Russia, the mainstream news media has collapsed as a vehicle for reliable information, creating a danger for the world, writes Robert Perry. By Robert Perry. Does any intelligent person look at a New York Times article about Russia or Vladimir Putin these days and expect to read an objective, balanced account? Or will it be laced with a predictable blend of contempt and ridicule? And is it any different at the Washington Post, NPR, MSNBC, CNN, or almost any mainstream the United States news outlet? And it's not just Russia. The same trend holds true for Iran, Syria, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and other countries and movements that have fallen onto the United States government's enemies list. We saw the same pattern with Saddam Hussein and Iraq before the 2003 the United States invasion, with Muammar Gaddafi and Libya before the U.S. orchestrated bombing campaign in 2011, and with President Viktor Yanukovych and Ukraine before the U.S.-backed coup in 2014. That is not to say that these countries and leaders don't deserve criticism, they do. But the proper role of the press corps, at least as I was taught during my early years at the Associated Press, was to treat all evidence objectively and all sides fairly. Just because you might not like someone doesn't mean your feelings should show through or the facts should be forced through a prism of bias. In those old days, that sort of behavior was deemed unprofessional and you would expect a senior editor to come down hard on you. Now, however, it seems that you'd only get punished if you quoted some dissident or allowed such a person onto an op-ed page or a talk show. Someone who didn't share official Washington's groupthink about the enemy. Deviation from groupthink has become the real disqualifier. Yet, this conformity should be shocking and unacceptable in a country that prides itself on freedom of thought and speech. Indeed, much of the criticism of enemy states is that they supposedly practice various forms of censorship and permit only regime-friendly propaganda to reach the public. But when was the last time you heard anyone in the United States mainstream say anything positive or even nuanced about Russian President Putin? He can only be portrayed as some shirtless buffoon or the devil incarnate. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton got widespread praise in 2014 when she likened him to Hitler. Or when has anyone in the United States media been allowed to suggest that Syria's President Bashar al-Assad and his supporters might actually have reason to fear what the United States press lovingly calls the moderate rebels, though they often operate under the military command of Sunni extremist groups, such as al-Qaeda's Nusra Front? See ConsortiumNews.com's Obama's Moderate Syrian Deception. For the first 3 years of the Syrian civil war, the only permissible the United States narrative was how the brutal Assad was slaughtering peaceful moderates, even though Defense Intelligence Agency analysts and other insiders had long been warning about the involvement of violent jihadists in the movement from the uprisings beginning in 2011. But that story was kept from the American people until the Islamic State started chopping off the heads of Western hostages in 2014, and since then, the mainstream the United States media has only reported the fuller story in a half-hearted and garbled way. See ConsortiumNews.com's Hidden Origins of Syria's Civil War. Reason for conformity. The reason for this conformity among journalists is simple: if you repeat the conventional wisdom, you might find yourself with a lucrative gig as a big-shot foreign correspondent, a regular TV talking head, or a visiting scholar at a major think tank. However, if you don't say what's expected, your career prospects aren't very bright. If you somehow were to find yourself in a mainstream setting and even mildly challenged the groupthink, you should expect to be denounced as a fill-in-the-blank apologist or stooge. A well-paid avatar of the conventional wisdom might even accuse you of being on the payroll of the despised leader. And you wouldn't likely get invited back. But the West's demonization of foreign enemies is not only an affront to free speech and meaningful democracy, it is also dangerous because it empowers unscrupulous American and European leaders to undertake violent and ill-considered actions that get lots of people killed and that spread hatred against the West. The most obvious recent example was the Iraq War, which was justified by a barrage of false and misleading claims about Iraq, which were mostly swallowed whole by a passive and complicit Western press corps. Key to that disaster was the demonization of Saddam Hussein, who was subjected to such unrelenting propaganda that almost no one dared question the baseless charges hurled at him about hiding WMD and collaborating with al-Qaeda. To do so would have made you a Saddam apologist or worse. The few who did dare raise their voices faced accusations of treason or were subjected to character assassination. Yet, even after their skepticism was vindicated as the pre-invasion accusations collapsed, there was very little reappraisal. Most of the skeptics remained marginalized, and virtually everyone who got the WMD story wrong escaped accountability. No accountability. For instance, Washington Post editorial page editor Fred Hyatt, who repeatedly reported Iraq's WMD as flat fact, suffered not a whit and remains in the same prestigious job, still enforcing one-sided group thinks about enemies. Carl Gershman, president of the National Endowment for Democracy. Carl Gershman, president of the National Endowment for Democracy. An example of how Hyatt and the Post continue to play the same role as neocon propagandists was on display last year in an editorial condemning Putin's government for shutting down Russian activities of the U.S.-funded National Endowment for Democracy and requiring foreign-funded groups seeking to influence Russian politics to register as foreign agents. In the Post's editorial and a companion op-ed by NED President Carl Gershman, you were led to believe that Putin was delusional, paranoid and power mad in his concern that outside money funneled into non-governmental organizations was a threat to Russian sovereignty. However, the Post and Gershman left out a few salient facts, such as the fact that NED is funded by the United States government and was the brainchild of Ronald Reagan's CIA director William J. Casey in 1983 to partially replace the CIA's historic role in creating propaganda and political fronts inside targeted nations. Also missing was the fact that Gershman himself announced in another Post op-ed that he saw Ukraine, prior to the 2014 coup, as the biggest prize and a stepping stone toward achieving Putin's ouster in Russia. The Post also forgot to mention that the Russian law about foreign agents was modeled after the United States statute entitled the Foreign Agent Registration Act. All those points would have given the Post's readers a fuller and fairer understanding of why Putin and Russia acted as they did, but that would have messed up the desired propaganda narrative seeking to demonize Putin. The goal was not to inform the American people but to manipulate them into a new Cold War hostility toward Russia. We've seen a similar pattern with the United States government's information warfare around high-profile incidents. In the old days, at least when I arrived in Washington in the late 1970s, there was much more skepticism among journalists about the official line from the White House or State Department. Indeed, it was a point of pride among journalists not to simply accept whatever the spokesman or officials were saying, but to check it out. There was plenty of enough evidence from the Tonkin Gulf lies to the Watergate cover-up to justify a critical examination of government claims. But that tradition has been lost, too. Despite the costly deceptions before the Iraq War, The Times, The Post, and other mainstream outlets simply accept whatever accusations the United States government hurls against enemies. Beyond the gullibility, there is even hostility toward those of us who insist on seeing real evidence. Examples of this continuing pattern include the acceptance of the United States government line on the sarin gas attack outside Damascus, Syria, on August 21, 2013, and the shootdown of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 over eastern Ukraine on July 17, 2014. The first was blamed on Syria's Assad and the second on Russia's Putin, quite convenient even though the United States officials refused to present any solid evidence to support their claims. Reasons for doubt. In both cases, there were obvious reasons to doubt the official story. Assad had just invited United Nations inspectors in to examine what he claimed were rebel chemical attacks, so why would he pick that time to launch a sarin attack just miles from where the inspectors were staying? Putin was trying to maintain a low profile for Russian support to Ukrainians resisting the U.S.-backed coup, but provision of a large, sophisticated, and powerful anti-aircraft battery lumbering around eastern Ukraine would just have invited detection. A photograph of a Russian Buk missile system that the United States ambassador to Ukraine Jeffrey Pyatt published on Twitter in support of a claim about Russia placing Buk missiles in eastern Ukraine, except that the image appears to be an AP photo taken at an air show near Moscow 2 years ago. A photograph of a Russian Buk missile system that the United States Ambassador to Ukraine Jeffrey Pyatt published on Twitter in support of a claim about Russia placing Buk missiles in eastern Ukraine, except that the image appears to be an AP photo taken at an air show near Moscow 2 years earlier. Further, in both cases, there was dissent among the United States intelligence analysts, some of whom objected at least to the Russia's judgment and offered different explanations for the incidents, pointing the blame in other possible directions. The dissent caused the Obama administration to resort to a new concoction called a government assessment, essentially a propaganda document rather than a classic intelligence assessment, which would express the consensus views of the 16 intelligence agencies and include areas of disagreement. So, there were plenty of reasons for Washington journalists to smell a rat or at least insist upon hard evidence to make the case against Assad and Putin. Instead, given the demonized views of Assad and Putin, mainstream journalists unanimously fell in line behind the official story. They even ignored or buried evidence that undermined the government's tales. Regarding the Syrian case, there was little interest in the scientific discovery that the one sarin-laden rocket, recovered by the UN, had a range of only about 2 kilometers, destroying Washington's claims about the Syrian government firing many rockets from 8 or 9 kilometers away. See consortiumnews.com's "Was Turkey Behind Syria's Sarin Attack?" Regarding the MH17 case, a blind eye was turned to a Dutch intelligence report that concluded that there were several operational Buk anti-aircraft missile batteries in eastern Ukraine, but they were all under the control of the Ukrainian military and that the rebels had no weapon that could reach the 33,000-foot altitude where MH17 was flying. See consortiumnews.com's "The Ever Curiouser MH17 Case." Though both those cases remain open and one cannot rule out new evidence emerging that bolsters the United States government's version of events, the fact that there are substantive reasons to doubt the official story should be reflected in how the mainstream Western media deals with these two sensitive issues. But the inconvenient facts are instead brushed aside or ignored, much as happened with Iraq's WMD. In short, there has been a system-wide collapse of the Western news media as a professional entity in dealing with foreign crises. So, as the world plunges deeper into crises inside Syria and on Russia's border, the West's citizens are going in almost blind without the eyes and ears of independent journalists on the ground and with major news outlets delivering incessant propaganda from Washington and other capitals. Instead of facts, the West's mainstream media traffics in demonization. Investigative reporter Robert Perry broke many of the Iran-Contra stories for the Associated Press and Newsweek in the 1980s. You can buy his latest book, America's Stolen Narrative, either in print here or as an e-book, from Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com.
Robert Perry is a very good writer, and I like him. He tends to go after the corporate media for all their lies about foreign leaders and so forth, and he tends to be anti-war, and I like that. So we're going to be running his articles on our website and on the radio show. You know what we need? A new zodiac. Yeah. The old ones depict an obsolete world. The archer, the water bearer. And talk about obsolete, virgin. What we need is a modern zodiac signs that represent today's reality. serial rapist, lone gunman, suicide bomber, paranoid schizophrenic, the transsexual crackhead, the money launderer, the disgruntled postal worker, the deceased homeless veteran, the South American drug lord, the third generation welfare recipient, the human immunodeficiency virus, and the personal trainer. In case you're one of those people who doesn't relate well to the real world, here's a nice, safe zodiac for you. The soccer mom, the sensitive male, the special needs child, the role model, the overachiever, the jogger, the little leaguer, the recycler, the anchor person, the anchor person, the codependent, the domino delivery boy, and recovering shopaholic. So there you got it. That's the new zodiac. You all ready for that? Well, it's obvious this Jew Debbie Wasserman, the national head of the Democrat Party, is throwing the game to Hillary, the bitch Hillary. The latest controversy roiling out of the Democratic Party showed no signs of abating Wednesday as Bernie Sanders' campaign put the onus of the rift-splitting Democrats on Debbie the Jew Wasserman Schultz. Failed leadership, accusing her of throwing shade on the Vermont senator from the beginning. The chaos that ensued Saturday in Nevada at its state convention over what some perceived as unfair delegate allocations erupted into the national scene and has lingered beyond two additional Democratic primaries, exposing the Democrat Party to infighting as the Republican Party takes steps to unify behind its presumptive presidential candidate. Sanders' campaign fired back at Wasserman Schultz on Wednesday morning after the Democrat convention. National committee chairman panned the campaign's anything for acceptable response to reports of violence and threats from Sanders supporters at the Nevada Democratic convention over the weekend. Yeah. Jeff Weaver, Sanders' campaign manager, pointedly accused Wasserman Schultz of undermining the Sanders campaign from the get-go and call into question her leadership. Quote, he categorically condemns any kind of threats that went on, absolutely unacceptable. Weaver told CNN on Wednesday before accusing Wasserman Schultz of throwing shade on Sanders' campaign since the very beginning, cited a limited debate schedule that featured weekend debates, the campaign's revoked access to its voter data, and a joint fundraising agreement with Hillary Clinton's campaign that Weaver said takes the money away from the state parties and goes to the Democratic National Committee. Well, it looks like we're going to have a couple of really hot conventions. Going to have a lot of fun at these conventions coming up in the fall, I'll tell you. Well, good old boy Ralph Nader said that Hillary Clinton's... Wait a minute, my microphone's clear out of the picture here. You probably couldn't hear me. Ralph Nader said that Hillary Clinton was going to clinch the Democratic nomination by a dictatorship. The 2000 Green Party presidential candidate is a fervent Bernie Sanders supporter, and he insisted that the race for a Democratic nomination was rigged in her favor. 25% of superdelegates are cronies, mostly, he said at an interview with U.S. News. They weren't elected. They were there in order to stop somebody like Bernie Sanders, who would win by the vote, unquote. So there you got it. Well, the U.S. is home to vastly more immigrants or invaders than any other country in the world, but its invader population is less diverse than many other nations, with more than a fourth of foreign-born residents originating from a single country. Guess what? Mexico! In a new compilation of immigration facts, the Pew Research Center examines U.S. migration patterns compared to the rest of the globe, highlighting that with 46.6 million invaders as of 2015, the U.S. by a wide margin has the most foreign-born peoples living within its borders. Oh, they wouldn't do that, would they? And what are white people going to do about it? Worry about Trump and the bitch. As of 2015, the United Nations estimates that 46.6 million people living in the United States were not born here. This means that, we might as well have let Russia invade us in the Cold War and taken over because they didn't have an army that big. But these non-whites do, 46.6 million. This means that about one in five international invaders, 19%, live in the U.S., the report reads. The U.S. invader population is nearly four times that of the world's next largest invader destination, Germany, with about 12 million invaders. They might as well let the Russians invade them back to World War II, they'd have had more whites come in. The U.S.-Mexico border is also the world's largest invader corridor, as Pew details, with some 12 million Mexico-born invaders living in the U.S. Oh, I know it's more than that. I think I met that many. The migration route dwarfs the second-largest corridor between India and the United Arab Emirates, where 3.5 million Indian invaders reside. While the U.S. has the largest population of newcomers and invaders from almost every country within its borders, the total invader population is not as diverse as other countries. Well, it's diverse enough for me, man. Roughly 1 in 4, 26% invaders in the U.S. come from just one country, Mexico. In several other destination countries, mainly Europe, the invaders are not as concentrated from a single country or handful of them, Pew reports. Perhaps counterintuitively, although the proportion of foreign-born people in the U.S. is at a record high, 1 in 7 U.S. residents are invaders. Other countries have a greater share of invaders than the U.S.? We're worried about our country. By way of comparison, about 1 in 5 people in Canada, 22%, are invader-born. Pew reports, in Australia, it's nearly 3 in 10, 28%. And in some Persian Gulf countries, such as Qatar, 75%, and United Arab Emirates, 88%. But the great majority of their resident populations are invaders, many of whom are actively recruited as foreign labor. Well, what do you think they do with the Mexicans for foreign labor in this country? What are you doing? According to Pew, a little over 3 million Americans live in other countries compared to 16 million Indian invaders and 12 million Mexicans who are largely living in the U.S. You wonder what that does to the job market, huh? Oh, no, it doesn't affect the job market. Even less populated countries like Syria, 5 million, and Poland, 4.4 million, have larger invader populations, Pew reports. As a share of the population in 2015, about 1% of the Americans born in the United States lived outside the United States. This is a considerably smaller share than that of other invader destinations like the UK, 8%, Germany, 5%, or Canada, 4%. All politicians lie, but some lie much more than others. Here's Hillary. Listen to this. Wait a minute here.
Marriage, now you're for it. You defended President Obama's immigration policies. Now you say they're too harsh. You supported his trade deal dozens of times. You even called it the gold standard. Now, suddenly last week, you're against it. Will you say anything to get elected?
Well, actually, I have been very consistent over the course of my entire life. I have always fought for the same values and principles.
Do you think New York State should recognize gay marriage?
No.
No. Okay.
believe that marriage is not just a bond, but a sacred bond between a man and a woman.
I have not supported same-sex marriage. I have supported civil partnerships and contractual relationships.
I support marriage for lesbian and gay couples. I support it personally and as a matter of policy and law.
So you're saying your opinion on gay marriage changed, or you changed your mind?
You know, I have to say, I think you are very persistent, but you are playing with my words and playing with what is such an
important issue. I'm just trying to clarify so I can understand.
No, I don't think you are trying to clarify. I think you're trying to say that, you know, I used to be opposed and now I'm in favor and I did it for political reasons, and that's just flat wrong. So let me just state what I feel like you are implying and repudiate it. I have a strong record. I have a great commitment to this issue, and I am proud of what I've done and the progress we're making.
Yeah, I'm saying, I'm sorry, I just want to clarify what I was saying. No, I was saying that you maybe really believed this all along, but, you know, believed in gay marriage all along, but felt for political reasons America wasn't ready yet and you couldn't say it. That's what I was thinking.
No, that is not true.
It really is great how long you've supported gay marriage.
Yeah. I could have supported it sooner.
Well, you did it pretty soon.
Yeah. Could have been sooner.
Fair point.
Just in July, New Hampshire, you told the crowd you, quote, take a backseat to no one when it comes to progressive values.
I take a backseat to no one when you look at my record and standing up and fighting for progressive values.
Last month in Ohio, you said you plead guilty to, quote, being kind of moderate and center. Do you change your political identity based on who you're talking to?
No. I think that, like most people that I know, I have a range of views, but they are rooted in my values and my experience.
You know, I get accused of being kind of moderate and center. I plead guilty.
Just for the record, are you a progressive or are you a moderate?
I'm a progressive.
Going through the emails, there were over 60,000 in total sent and received. About half were work-related and went to the State Department, and about half were personal, that were not in any way related to my work.
When you speak to the public, you say, I turned over everything. That's, for the most part, a direct quote. When you talk to the public, you say, I turned over everything.
90 to 95% of my work-related emails were in the state system. If they wanted to see them, they would certainly have been able to do so.
You know what? That is maybe the 10th time you have cited that figure today.
It is.
And I have not heard anyone other than you ever cite that figure. Who told you that 90 to 95% of your emails were in the State Department system? Who told you that?
We learned that from the State Department in their analysis of the emails that were already on the system.
The Inspector General report found that less than 1% of State Department emails, record emails, were captured. So they give a number of less than 1%, and you give a number of 90%.
I have absolute confidence that everything that could be in any way connected to work is now in the possession of the State Department.
This pile represents the emails that you sent or received about Libya in 2011, from February through December of 2011. This pile represents the emails you sent or received from early 2012 until the day of the attack. There are 795 emails in this pile. We've counted them. There are 67 emails in this pile in 2012. And I'm troubled by what I see here. I can only conclude by your own records that there was a lack of interest in Libya in 2012.
The server contains personal communications from my husband and me.
Only time I got on the internet, I did two emails. And I ordered Christmas presents from a reservation. Otherwise, I found people said embarrassing things on emails. I didn't want to be one of them.
I mean,
And how many angels dance on the head of a pin? I have really nothing to, I mean, how do you answer that?
I represented Wall Street as a senator from New York, and I went to Wall Street in December of 2007 before the big crash that we had. And I basically said, cut it out. Quit foreclosing on homes. Quit engaging in these kinds of speculative behaviors.
Now, who's exactly to blame for the housing crisis? I think there's plenty of blame to go around. Home buyers who paid extra fees to avoid documenting their income should have known they were getting in over their heads.
Of course, we have to deal with the problem that the banks are still too big to fail. We can never let the American taxpayer and middle-class families ever have to bail out the kind of speculative behavior that we saw. But we also have to worry about some of the other players. AIG, a big insurance company. Lehman Brothers, an investment bank. There's this whole area called shadow banking. That's where the experts tell me the next potential problem could come from. So I'm with both Senator Sanders and Governor O'Malley in putting a lot of attention onto the banks. And the plan that I have put forward would actually empower regulators to break up big banks. I represented New York, and I represented New York on 9/11. When we were attacked, where were we attacked? We were attacked in downtown Manhattan, where Wall Street is. I did spend a whole lot of time and effort helping them rebuild. That was good for New York, it was good for the economy, and it was a way to rebuke the terrorists who had attacked our country.
9/11 was bad.
I agree with that.
Well, it goes on and on and on and on, and I never seen such, you know, all politicians are liars. All presidents are liars. Most of them are warmongers. I mean, you know, you don't know whether to cry or laugh. But since worse is better, what can I say? Well, guess what? We get some more new visitors. Shelters and churches in El Paso, Texas are preparing to receive as many as 350 Cuban invaders a day. And there is concern the demand will be overwhelming. They'll come through the Santa Fe International Bridge that connects Ciudad Juarez, where in recent weeks, plane loads of Cuban invaders have been flown from Panama, Costa Rica, and other Central American countries that don't want them there. I wonder why. Through temporary assistance for needy families, federal program, these invaders get financial support, roughly $420 a month as they go through the work authorization process and apply for employment services. But the aid, which is being channeled exclusively through the diocesan, here we go, the churches, migrant and refugee services may be insufficient given the proportions of the current influx. In other words, the churches are greasing the tracks. Again, the churches. We have limited funds, maybe for 100 people, and now we are expecting a lot more than that, said Melissa Lopez, executive director of Refugee Services, which serves Cubans, Haitians, and Dominican families. Bring them on in, baby. Bring them on in, goddammit. She explained that her center operates on three-year programs aimed at helping approximately 60 Cubans a month, which is the number of people they have typically served in the past. In the past 3 years, we had 60 Cubans a month. This year we had served 100 Cubans a month, and now it's going to be up to 350 Cubans a month. Why not? Why not? And this from Montana. State officials are not allowed to report the immigration status of people seeking state services, i.e. welfare. The state's high court ruled on Tuesday. Yeah, these judges, jeez, yeah. In a unanimous decision, the court struck down the last piece of voter-approved law meant to deter undocumented invader immigrants from living and working in the Treasure State, which upholds a 2014 ruling stating that the law denying unemployment benefits, university enrollment, and other services to people who are in the country illegally was unconstitutional. Yeah, there you go. The Montana Supreme Swine went further, rejecting the one remaining position that required state workers to report to federal immigration officials the names of applicants who are in the U.S. without papers. The risk of inconsistent and inaccurate judgments issued from a multitude of state agents untrained in immigration law and unconstrained by any articulated standards is evident, Justice Patricia the Asshole Cotter wrote in an opinion. Oh, French Revolution? It's beginning to sound pretty good. I used to think it was too brutal, but I don't think so anymore. Well, let's close out with at least a little bit of humor here. Here's something I can do without. People ahead of me in the supermarket line are paying for an inexpensive item by credit card or personal check. People, take my word for this. Tic Tacs is not a major purchase. And I get just as discouraged when a guy who's buying a simple jar of spaghetti sauce tries to pay with a letter of credit from the Bank of Liechtenstein. Folks, carry some fucking money around, will you? It comes in handy. No one should be borrowing money from a bank at 18% interest to buy a loaf of bread. And what about these cretins at the airport gift shop who think somehow they're in the Mall of America? It's an airport. I'm standing there with one newspaper and a pack of gum. I gotta get to my plane. Why does the genetic defective ahead of me choose this moment to purchase a complete set of dishes or a new fall wardrobe? What is this, fucking Macy's? And of course, the clerk lady has to carefully wrap each dish separately, but she's working real fast because she's 89. Plus, she's from Sri Lanka, the rural part of Sri Lanka. And now dish man wants to know if it's okay to use Turkish traveler's checks. You know what I do? I steal things. Fuck 'em. I grab a handful of candy and 6 magazines and head for the gate. My attitude, it wasn't their stuff to begin with. And that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow, Thursday. And don't forget David Lane, our fallen comrade who was murdered here in Indiana at the prison. Definitely murdered. 14-5. And he wasn't murdered by inmates either. He was murdered by the staff.